Welcome to the Hogan Lovells National Security Podcast, discussing and analyzing the legal implications of national security issues across the globe. Our hosts, Hogan Lovells attorneys Michael Scheimer and Tim Bergreen, have decades of hands-on experience in national security issues and how they relate to their clients' day-to-day goals. And now, here are Michael and Tim.
Hey, Tim, nice to see you. Welcome back.
Mike, how are you? It's a cold, rainy Tuesday, 2 days before Thanksgiving, November 21st, for those of you keeping track. And we have a very special guest with us this afternoon, Mike.
Yeah, we've invited our colleague, Kellyanne Shaw, to come back on the show. Kellyanne, thank you for joining us again.
Thank you so much for having me. And I will say, for the record, as someone who's from Seattle, I love the rain.
Well, Kellyanne, we invited you on because we have a sort of a recent development in trade and national security that we wanted to get your views on. And we'll talk a little further about your prior experience at these events in the past. But for the benefit of our listeners, can you explain to everybody what APEC and the IPF forums and summits were that just took place in San Francisco about a week ago?
Yeah, last week was one of President Biden's biggest diplomatic weeks of his entire presidency. There were a number of very high-profile events happening, along with about two dozen world leaders who all gathered in San Francisco for two primary meetings. One of them is APEC, so the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation. And what that is, for those who aren't familiar, it's a regional forum of Asia-Pacific economies, 21 in total, so 20 plus the United States, who have been meeting since 1989 and have had leader summits since 1993 to discuss a range of economic, trade, investment, and development issues that impact the entire region. The rules that come out of APEC are non-binding. They are voluntary, but it has served a really important incubator function in creating policy that finds its way into other trade agreements and multilateral forums like the WTO, which we can talk about. And so for those who participate, is a really important economic forum.
And then there was IPEF, I think you mentioned as well, Mike.
Right. So IPEF, I-P-E-F, as it's spelled out, stands for the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework. And this is an initiative of the Biden administration that was launched in May of 2022. And it was effectively designed to be the U.S. economic blueprint for the Asia-Pacific region. So while APEC has both Russia and China as members, along with the other economies, IPEF was designed to be the response. So it includes India, for example, but does not include China. So the reference to the Indo-Pacific is effectively a geographic area that includes most of the Pacific and Asian nations that runs through India and does not go north to China. But the IPEF initiative was formulated with four specific pillars in mind, and we can talk about what was actually achieved in a bit. But the pillars comprise trade, supply chains, clean energy, and fair economy, which is like anti-corruption and tax issues. And those have been negotiated amongst the 14 participating countries for the past year and a half.
You know, before we do that, Kellyanne, before we got on the air this afternoon, you were talking with Mike and me about your own experiences at APEC. And I think that it'd be kind of interesting for our listeners to hear what your own history is with the negotiations during, I believe it was the Trump administration, when you were on the White House staff.
Yeah, happy to share. So between 2018 and 2019, I served as Deputy Assistant to the President for International Economics, which basically meant I ran an office at both the National Security Council and the National Economic Council that was in charge of global economic policy. And in that role, served as the lead White House negotiator for APEC for both of those summit years. And I had quite an interesting experience during the 2018 summit, which was hosted by Papua New Guinea. About a week before the summit, I arrived to negotiate what is called the leaders' communique, or basically the joint declaration among all of the leaders participating. And I arrived to Chinese flags lining the street, leading up to the buildings where negotiators and delegates were supposed to meet that China had built and paid for as part of a development initiative. President Xi was there having a state visit as well, and I arrived to the table to some pretty unfriendly and unhappy faces. At that point, it was during the Trump administration. We had pulled out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which was the Obama-era trade agreement involving a number of those same Asia-Pacific countries. We had implemented steel and aluminum, 232 tariffs against most of the countries sitting around the table. And there was a real question as to whether the United States wanted to be engaged in the region. And so my team and I spent the entire week leading up to the summit negotiating commitments, making clear the United States wasn't going anywhere, that we wanted to be part of the forum, and that even though we use different language to describe trade and some of the other issues that other countries had grown accustomed to describing in a different way, that in a large part, we meant the same thing on a lot of issues. And just because we said it one way before didn't mean we had to use the exact same language moving forward. So by the end of the week, we had actually received or achieved consensus in the opposite direction. We had 20 economies to one, with China being the one isolated economy. And it became so uncomfortable that Chinese negotiators were barging into conference rooms. They were cussing me and my team out, calling us names, using expletives. And the night before the leaders were supposed to meet to agree to the joint communique, Chinese officials actually physically went to one of the officials of Papua New Guinea to his office and threatened him and tried to get him to change the communique to drop references to things like unfair trade practices. So ultimately, the entire summit fell apart, and it was the first time in nearly 30 years that APEC was not able to agree to a joint consensus statement. And while that was truly unfortunate and devastating for those who had spent the whole week working towards that, what was a positive outcome was it was clear that the United States wasn't going anywhere to everybody in that room. And the fact that both the United States and China fought so hard to be there and to be part of the Indo-Pacific and the Asia-Pacific just goes to show that beyond the commercial rules that come out of these summits, there's real geopolitical and strategic value to participating and to actively hosting as the U.S. did this year.
So I couldn't agree more on the sort of the, you know, intrinsic value of trade and trade negotiations to our national security toolbox. And I think generally it's something that has been underutilized over the last few years. I'd like to turn now to IPEF, though, because your experience in 2018, I think, will sort of lend a little bit of color to what actually happened in San Francisco over the last couple of weeks. You made reference to the four pillars of IPEF a couple of minutes ago, and pillar one was the trade pillar, and you know, a lot went down regarding the trade pillar, or did not go down regarding the trade pillar over the last couple of weeks, but maybe you could let our listeners know what the other three pillars are, and then maybe sort of go through what happened with the first pillar in San Francisco.
Yeah, happy to. And this is a really interesting but unfortunate story. So in San Francisco, we talked about APEC. We also mentioned IPEF. The Biden-Xi meeting was the other big event happening. And before the week, last week, the administration had been actively trying to downplay any meaningful outcomes of either APEC, because again, you've got China and Russia and all decisions are made through consensus, or the Biden-Xi meeting. And so IPEF was really being teed up as the most significant deliverable of the week, and it was going to be Biden's answer to China, the U.S. blueprint for economic engagement in the Indo-Pacific. And the big announcement was supposed to be the substantive conclusion of all four pillars. So the pillar one was trade, pillar two was supply chain, pillar three was clean economy, and pillar four was fair economy. Over the summer, the administration released the text of the supply chain pillar, so that was already concluded. So we were awaiting the negotiators to finalize the text for the other three pillars. But just days before the summit, Senator Sherrod Brown from Ohio, along with Senate Finance Chairman Wyden, requested that the administration not conclude the trade pillar on the basis that there were no enforceable commitments on labor. So part of the dynamic here, and if I'm just rewinding for a second to give the listeners a bit of context, is that trade has been a relatively dry agenda item for the Biden administration for a number of reasons, but largely because of the political toxicity and the belief in the administration that Clinton lost the election because she pushed too hard for the TPP Trans-Pacific Partnership. And so there has been a real conundrum about what to do about this. And the administration has refrained from negotiating any new FTAs or anything that looks like a comprehensive, broad trade deal. So in setting out to negotiate this trade pillar for IPEF, they were very determined to make it not the TPP. So very clear that this was not meant to be a broad FTA. It was not meant to be the same thing that Obama did. It was something else entirely, focused on things like trade facilitation, like transparency, customs regulations, standards, food safety for agriculture, but not involving market access, so tariffs. Now, the political right was largely disappointed in the administration's decision to not negotiate market access or tariffs, because that's something that typically business and agriculture ask for. But on the political left, while they supported the decision not to include tariffs or the market access component, they were insistent on having meaningful labor commitments. In trade negotiations, it is very hard to get any meaningful commitments on just about anything without incentivizing the ask through market access or tariffs. So because the level of ambition was so low to begin with, the negotiations actually imploded in themselves, in that IPEF became a political orphan, without support on the right, and at the end, no support on the left. And so the administration made the decision just a couple of days before the summit to pull down the trade pillar, and they announced that they would be continuing to negotiate into 2024. But I think that most people are expecting that there will not be a trade pillar at the end of this year, because there doesn't seem to be any more leverage the administration has now that they didn't have before the summit to get meaningful commitments on labor, climate, or any other of the issues that might satisfy the progressive left. So what does this mean? I've just given you a big windup of the context and the background on this. It means that the most commercially significant part of Biden's economic plan for the Indo-Pacific just didn't happen. And I think it really undermined the big rollout, his big plan for the region. And while, you know, China may have not had anything to do with the fact that the trade pillar didn't work out, it really is viewed as an unforced error and a hat tip to China, as she was here and he didn't have to face the fact that a bunch of other Asia Pacific countries were coming up with a plan without him.
You know, you're someone who's worked in this space for a while, and I think that there must be a sort of enduring sense of frustration, you know, among sort of trade professionals and trade adjacent professionals over the seeming inability of, you know, the political parties and the separate branches of government to come to real meaningful trade agreements. That seems to be an enduring problem, you know, across administrations and across congressional majorities.
Yeah, and I should say that this is not a partisan issue anymore. You will find just as many Republicans as you will Democrats on one side of this issue or the other. There is a real question right now as to whether or not the U.S. should be engaging in trade negotiations with allied countries. And the argument for not doing so falls into what I call the economic security camp. The United States should focus instead on building out its domestic economy. And if you're a Democrat, you think that's largely through industrial policies like those that the Biden administration has been pursuing. And if you're a Republican, you probably think that's through tax incentives and making us energy independent again. So that's where the focus of the economic security camp is. If you're more on the national security side, you're acutely aware of the fact that if we are not negotiating trade agreements with our allied partners, they're going to negotiate them without us. And so every day that we sit by, our market access and our ability to export becomes less and less competitive as other countries are getting a better deal while we're not. And so there's this balance that's having to take place between those who are more of the protectionist versus the free market camp. And it's really playing out in situations like this, where the U.S. doesn't seem to have an answer to the Indo-Pacific. We're not in the Trans-Pacific Partnership. We're now the CPTPP agreement. China has applied for membership. The U.K. just joined. And the World Trade Organization is effectively paralyzed at the moment in terms of negotiating any better deal. So the United States is really going to have to decide which direction it wants to go on this issue. And yeah, I think the Biden administration is finding it very challenging to navigate the politics, particularly on the Democratic side. But I'm not sure a Republican president would fare a whole lot better in this political climate either.
Kellyanne, we had you on before to talk about supply chains and critical minerals in the past. And I heard some coming out of the IPEF summit, an agreement to have a dialogue on critical minerals and supply chains. Could you comment on sort of how realistic is that? Is this just kind of a little more talk? But certainly, the critical mineral space is something that we think is very critical for national security, as opposed to maybe other trade type topics with the allies. And also, this is something we've had you on before to talk about. So what do you think that accomplished what it set out to do and what comes next?
I mean, this is obviously an area of huge importance and significance. Right now, what I will say is the jury is out. So part of the challenge with IPEF, and if you wanted to be critical of it, you would say, well, it's not binding. It's not subject to dispute settlement. The rules aren't enforceable. So is this just another talk shop? Are we actually going to see meaningful outcomes and meaningful rerouting of supply chains? And I think those on the other side who are supportive of the initiative would say, you know, give us a chance. We're setting up a framework here, a platform for how we want to work these issues moving forward. And let's just see if this process works out. I am sort of in the skeptical camp myself. I think that there's been a lot of talk of critical minerals for the past several years. And again, not a partisan issue, just the United States is trying to figure out how to handle its overdependence on China, along with allied partners who are looking to diversify those supply chains as well. And there isn't really a silver bullet for this. As we talked about last time, there's a lot of different policies that could potentially work in this space, including recycling, including creating captive markets, including the need for permitting. You know, what do you do about the most environmentally damaging processing part of the critical mineral supply chain? Who wants that in their backyard? So there are a lot of questions that have to be answered. Again, I think some progress is better than none, but we'll have to see how this plays out. I'm not betting a lot of money on this solving our critical mineral problem, but I do think it will help at least in giving us another forum to discuss possible solutions.
So let's look ahead, if we can, Kellyanne, coming out of APEC 2023, and I believe it's the Peruvians, is that correct, will be hosting 2024. And, you know, what do you foresee in that forum going forward over the next year? Obviously, we've got an election in November of next year. The Taiwanese, which are another one of the economies represented in APEC, have an election in mid-January. And there's sort of a lot going on. Do you see things moving along at all? And what do you see the Peruvians emphasizing during their, I don't know whether you call it the presidency or chairmanship of the forum?
I think those are all good questions. You know, one outcome that may not sound like an outcome, but in terms of APEC, I think it really is the fact that they were able to arrive at a consensus statement. That is no small feat given the number of countries and the various views around the table on certain geopolitical issues that have been overshadowing a lot of the work in APEC for the year. So obviously, the invasion of Ukraine, right? It's difficult to get Russia to sign on to any statement condemning that action. But the other issue that I heard played a pretty significant role in this year's summit was the Israel-Gaza conflict and the fact that Malaysia, Brunei, and Indonesia were all looking for language condemning Israel's actions. And there were a number of other countries, including the United States, who said absolutely not. And so what they were able to do is move the most controversial geopolitical issues onto what's called a chair statement. So it's basically the chair will summarize the different views in the room, but there's no consensus as to those views, and then push everything else. So the more technical work of APEC, the more trade-related, technocratic issues onto a consensus-based statement. And I think that approach proved really effective. And it was the first time in this entire host year that the United States had been able to pull that off. So what I think that does is it gives Peru a blueprint for next year for saying there are some things that are bigger than this forum that countries have stronger views on. We can't resolve it. It's not part of our mandate. So let's focus instead on some of the technical work that we can do instead. But the challenge APEC always has is its number one function is that of an incubator. So it's a close relationship with business through the ABAC Council, through a CEO summit that happens alongside of the leaders and the government officials getting together. There's a real give and take. It's a real brainstorm exercise about how are we going to solve discrete issues in the trade, economic, investment, and development space in the region that then sort of get shipped off into other agreements that have real teeth. But if there are no agreements right now that are being negotiated that have real teeth, which is mostly in the WTO context where these rules have gone, there is a real question about how this work progresses and what that means. So I think Peru is still going to have its challenges for its own host year. But I do think that the U.S. host year at least gave them a blueprint for potentially getting some work done in the more narrow technical areas.
The intermingling of the public and private sector at APEC is, I think, an interesting facet. And is that something that is continued during the events between the actual forums themselves, or is that mostly a creature of the annual meetings?
No, it happens all year. And what I will say is, in my role in government, I was a U.S. negotiator for a decade. And I was the lead U.S. negotiator for the G20, the G7. And so this relationship between the APEC summit and the business community is really unique to this forum. And while there is certainly interaction between business and world leaders in other contexts, it's not as developed and it's not as permanent. So even if you look at the leader's declaration, for example, there's reference to working with the business community, which is not something you see in other global forums. So it happens all year long. The APEC Council is assigned to whoever the host country is. So next year, it will be the Peruvian business community that is leading the effort to integrate business and global leaders. And there are a lot of different companies and trade associations who show up on the forum of these events, because you've got technocrats, you have political advisors, you have world leaders who are all really receptive to hearing what stakeholders have to say. And that's unique to APEC.
And then one last question for me. So is IPEF, is that twinned on an annual basis with APEC?
So the IPEF summit that occurred this last week was the first one ever. And it was meant to be the launch of the actual text, so the actual four pillars. And again, it was a U.S. deliverable, so the U.S. decided to co-host them together. But I would not be surprised if you saw some overlap. So in addition to IPEF and APEC, you also had a CPTPP ministerial happening in San Francisco, which, of course, the U.S. was not a part of. But because you had so many world leaders and ministers already gathered in one place, it is easy enough to piggyback on that travel. So I would not be surprised, at least throughout the rest of the Biden administration, if you saw some of those meetings continuing to happen in parallel. But I would also say one of the administration's decisions with IPEF was not to seek congressional approval, meaning that Congress effectively had no role other than, you know, sort of loosely overseeing the negotiations. So this is not written in U.S. legislation, which means if there is a different administration, they could choose to continue with IPEF or not. And it would be pretty easy to unwind IPEF in a different administration. So there are questions as to the durability of this initiative, too, although I think the Biden administration folks would tell you otherwise.
And the administration's decision to go it alone, as it were, has rankled a lot of folks on the Hill.
Absolutely. I think especially when it comes to trade issues and economic issues, there's a tremendous amount of attention right now between Congress and the administration, not just in terms of whether or not consultations are happening, but whether the U.S. policy is actually going in a direction that both branches of government support. And I think there are a lot of folks on the Hill who would tell you it's not.
Well, Kellyanne, we want to thank you so much. You've been incredibly generous with your time. Learned a lot. Hope the listeners have, and want to wish you a happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving to you guys as well.
Yeah, thanks for being on the show. We appreciate you joining us once again, and I'm sure we're going to pick up on some of the different topics that were touched on, particularly in some of the pillars. So have a good holiday, everyone.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Hogan Lovells National Security Podcast. To learn more about top 10 global law firm Hogan Lovells with more than 50 offices worldwide, please visit HoganLovells.com.